From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with director David Cronenberg about Crash, his disturbing new film about the mysterious eroticism of cars, car crashes, and wounds. The film is so disturbing it almost didn't open in America, but it was given a special prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Cronenberg's previous films include The Fly, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and M. Butterfly. Crash is based on a 1973 novel by J.G. Ballard, who we'll also hear from. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton opens his summit with Russian President Boris Yeltsin today in Helsinki. Both leaders say they're committed to peace between both nations, but they're divided on how to reach it. Russian officials have complained loudly about NATO's plans to admit former Soviet states into the Western military alliance with the strong support of the United States. NPR's Mara Liasson is traveling with the president. She says NATO will be a tough matter to negotiate around.
NATO is going to expand. The U.S. is quite firm about that. The Russians are adamantly opposed, and the Russians aren't even expecting anything to change on that count. What they do hope to happen, the U.S. would like Russia to go home feeling secure, feeling that NATO is not a threat to them. And also they hope that Russia can go home with a few new accomplishments that can at least ease the pain of NATO membership. For instance, some kind of an enhanced membership status in the G7 group of nations, or a promise of further arms control, missile reductions beyond the treaty that is currently before the Duma, the START-2 treaty.
NPR's Mara Liasson. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan is hinting the central bank could increase short-term interest rates. Speaking to the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, Greenspan called the economy quite favorable, but he's wondering how long that can go on before prices start to go up. He says it's important, therefore, for the Federal Reserve to act preemptively and increase interest rates to keep inflation well under control.
Unless monetary policy is forward-looking, unless of necessity as a consequence, it tends where it needs to be, preemptive, that we will find our ability to maintain and foster a low inflation environment and eventually to achieve price stability will be jeopardized.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan. Israeli warplanes today attacked suspected guerrilla bases in northern Lebanon near the Syrian border. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The Israeli jets attacked a village in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, only 6 miles from the Syrian border. There was no immediate word of casualties or damage. The Israeli jets targeted bases that allegedly belong to the Hezbollah guerrilla group. Such raids are fairly common, but it is unusual for Israel to attack positions so deep in Lebanese territory. The Israeli raid was apparently in retaliation for an attack yesterday by Hezbollah guerrillas that killed one Israeli soldier and wounded 3 others. Hezbollah, or Party of God, has been fighting a guerrilla war for more than a decade in an effort to oust Israel from the 9-mile-wide strip of land it occupies in southern Lebanon. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 42.5 points at 6,835. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, much of the stock market is lower after Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan increased expectations for higher interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
This morning, Greenspan told the Joint Economic Committee of Congress it was important to act promptly to control inflation, which may accelerate as the result of strong consumer demand. He also said a tight labor market is likely to produce pricing pressures. The stock market's decline is being led by tobacco issues. Liggett Group's tobacco unit has offered to label cigarette packages with warnings that smoking is addictive. That admission would hurt the defense of the entire tobacco industry. On the other hand, shares in U.S. Bancorp are higher by more than 13% after agreeing to be acquired by First Bank System for $9 billion in stock. I'm Doug Krisner.
New York state regulators have conditionally approved the merger of Bell Atlantic and NYNEX. If the conditions of the New York State Public Service Commission are accepted by the two telephone firms, it would clear the last state hurdle to the $23 billion merger. The Federal Communications Commission and the Justice Department must still finish their reviews of the deal. American Airlines and its pilots say they've reached an agreement in principle that settles their contract dispute. The conflict has threatened to upset the nation's air travel system. A pilots' union official says negotiators are still working on details, but a contract proposal is supposed to go to the union's board tomorrow. An airline spokesman says the talks are still going on. Americans, managers, and pilots have differed over wages and who will fly smaller jets that the company plans to use on some commuter routes. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Crash is very disturbing. It's about a subculture of people who have sexualized cars and car crashes. They find crashes and even wounds mysteriously arousing. Ted Turner was so disturbed by the film he held up its American release for several months. But the Cannes Film Festival awarded Crash a special jury prize for originality, daring, and audacity. My guest David Cronenberg directed the film and adapted the screenplay from J.G. Ballard's 1973 novel. Throughout Cronenberg's career, he has used the horror genre to examine larger themes of body, spirit, pathology, death, and transcendence. His films include Scanners, The Fly, The Dead Zone, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and M. Butterfly. In the movie Crash, James Spader plays a character named after the author J.G. Ballard. Elias Koteas plays Vaughn, the leader of this crash subculture. He's obsessed with cars, driving them, having sex in them, and crashing them. He even restages crashes that have killed cult heroes like James Dean and Jane Mansfield. Here's Vaughn driving with Ballard.
I've always wanted to drive a crash car.
You could get your wish at any moment.
No, I mean a crash car with a history. Camus, Fassel Vega, Nathaniel West's station wagon, Grace Kelly's Rover 3500. Just fix it enough to get a roll. Don't clean it. Don't touch anything else.
Is that why you drive this car? Do you see Kennedy's assassination as a special kind of car crash?
The case can be made.
Whoa, what the? Oh, God.
Here. Take a look at this. Tell me what you think of these. Yeah, you recognize this one. This is James Dean. This is the next one Seagrave and I are going to do. Jane Mansfield.
It's all very satisfying. Not sure I understand why.
What did you respond to in the novel about the idea of a subculture that has eroticized and fetishized car crashes?
Well, of course, when I first read the book, I wasn't thinking that I was responding to it, at least in the sense of, you know, enough to make a film about it. I found the book very disturbing and unrelenting, and I felt that it sort of opened a very strange window, which I couldn't get closed again. But it, in a sense, that's one of the reasons I made the movie, was to understand what there was about the book that made me have to make the movie. And I'm not sure that I can completely be articulate about it because some of the things that I was doing in the movie are, I believe, beyond being articulated. I mean, that's one of the reasons you do it that way rather than just talking about it. But as a meditation on sex, technology, and death, Crash is really kind of unprecedented, certainly in my experience. Just its oblique angles that it takes on all of those things. Of course, sex and death have been linked since the Greeks and beyond, you know, Eros and Thanatos, and the understanding of the connection between those two goes quite deep in human culture. But the added understanding of technology and how that fits in the middle of sex and death, I think that was the unique thing that Ballard brought to me with that book.
What's the connection that characters make between car crashes and sex?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, how conscious are the characters really of what they're doing in a philosophical way? I'm not so sure that they are conscious of it. So we might watch them, and that's one of the reasons, of course, that I think in a way of a film as an experiment where you allow your characters to experience things that perhaps you can't or you wouldn't want to. But it gives you a chance to observe what might happen to you if you did these things. So my take on it is maybe not the same as the characters would be. But I really do believe that we instantly eroticize all our technology. It's, you know, people sometimes talk about, you know, look what technology is doing to us. But I have to say, but technology is us. So it's really us doing it to us. I mean, really, all technology is an extension of our own nervous systems, our own bodies, and it becomes this strange reflecting mirror of the human will. I mean, technology I really see as the physical incarnation of the human will.
Oh, so, let me just stop you there and say you really go into that in Videodrome.
Yes. Oh, yes. It's so interesting to me because people who look at, you know, who knew the book Crash and say, oh my God, Cronenberg's doing Crash, that's so perfect, it's so obvious. But it wasn't obvious to me when I read the book at all. It's only obvious after the fact, you know. These are themes certainly that I've dealt with before in some ways, but the car crash and sort of the automobile as an emblem of technology, when in fact most people think, I don't even think people think of the car as technology anymore. It's so, and that's what makes it perfect.
Cars are already eroticized in our culture. In the 50s and 60s, car campaigns always had a beautiful woman in them, you know, in the advertisement. And cars have a long history as mobile bedrooms for people. How do you think that figures into the resonance of the story?
Well, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, everybody understands that cars can be sexy or sexual in some way. On the other hand, there's an incredible taboo connecting sex with death, people, or even sex with danger, even though, once again, those connections are very well known, very understood, and very old and primitive. So I think one of the things that Ballard did was to dive directly and deeply into that taboo and kind of rip it apart and just start talking about everything that was not supposed to be talked about. In other words, I think you can see that ambivalence in the way people respond to car crashes. It's, everyone knows that people slow down, everyone lifts off the accelerator, that little bit passing a car crash. And in a way, the movie Crash is a car crash for the audience, that they are cruising past and they are glancing at it and they have that same ambivalent attitude toward it, which is to say, they're fascinated by it, they're repelled by their own fascination at the same time. They see the victims. Part of them is glad that it's not them. Another part of them fears that the next time it will be them, and so on and so on. So I think that's really the unique angle of attack that Ballard had that I take also for the movie.
What about you when you pass a car crash? Do you look or not look?
I'm ambivalent too. You know, I mean, I tend to look, but I'm sort of conscious that I'm forcing myself to look. I also hate the idea that other car crashes can be caused by your looking at the first car crash, you know, and that has happened as well. You get these multiple pileups because people have been slowing down to look at a car crash. So there, you know, there's a survival element there when I'm actually on the road as well.
Well, when I spoke with J.G. Ballard about Crash, he said that he was very conscious of the fact that in the 70s, the media landscape seemed so hungry for sensation and violence was beginning to take the place sex had occupied. And people were looking for a new thrill, and movies and TV and even TV news had become more violent. And he wanted to look at the way that violence was entering people's imaginations, and Crash just took a very extreme example of that. Do you share that vision of Crash with him, that it's somehow about this hunger for new sensation and about the media landscape?
No, I don't. And I think maybe Ballard's take on his own book would be different now. Of course, I've talked to him very recently about it, and we were, in fact, on stage together at the London Film Festival discussing our responses to everything, the movie and the book, in front of an audience. And the book was written 25 years ago, of course, and things have definitely changed now. And of course, filtering the book through my own sensibility to make the movie 25 years later, obviously things were going to change. And in fact, the movie Crash is really not violent. I mean, there are no... It's perceived as violent by people, but really there are no guns or knives or, you know, nobody's shot or stabbed or clubbed or kicked in the head, things that you see all the time in action movies. There's none of that in Crash. Nobody's even sort of slapped, in fact. But it's still perceived as violent, and I think the reason is that it's conceptually violent. It does violence to people's conceptions of what is normal and proper and acceptable. And so I think my whole approach to the book was... Of course, I had the book to build on, and the book also had a history that I could build on as well. So I was able to launch myself from a different pad than Ballard did when he was writing the book. I think things have shifted. So the point is, what is most disturbing, in fact, to people about the movie often is the sexuality, not the violence.
David Cronenberg is my guest, and his new film is Crash. You've called Crash an existentialist romance. What do you mean by that?
I think that the characters are really embarked on the classic existential project, you know, which is to understand that, as Sartre put it, you know, man is condemned to be free, by which he meant that really we are inventing everything. I mean, we are creating our own reality, that there is no morality in the universe, no ethical system other than what humans create. This is, of course, an atheistic understanding of the world. In other words, there is no God who hands you down the rules and you have to obey them. Even more scary than that God doing that is to think that there is no God and that the responsibility for creating all these things is totally on the shoulders of man himself. And that's really where I am. I mean, I think of myself as a humanist in the sense that I'm accepting that if we want morality, if we want an ethical order or structure in the universe, it must come from us. We have to create it, and it will not come from someplace else. So the characters in the film are, in fact, without being once again conscious of it as characters, but they have embarked on this process. When we first meet them, we find characters for whom the old forms of sexuality, of love, of marriage, of morality, of emotion even, all of these things that are often thought to be some kind of absolute, these things have no meaning for them anymore. They're really just going through the motions. And because of, for various reasons, primarily because the character who is also named James Ballard in the book and in the movie, has a car crash which comes to him as an epiphany, as a revelation of how his life has come apart and how his body has come apart and how he must put all of those things back together again. So we have characters who are, in fact, reinventing sex, love, marriage, emotion, morality. That is what they're doing in the film. And to me, that's an existential project. And the romantic part is that it is also a love story, a very strange one, but it is a story involving the two major characters, a married couple, who really have to come through a very strange, circuitous route to come back to being able to express love to each other, which you really maybe only see and understand in the last scene of the movie, which, as it happens, is not in the book.
My guest is David Cronenberg, director of the new film Crash. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Cronenberg, he directed the new film Crash, about a group of people who are erotically aroused by cars and crashes. You've made several horror films during your career. And in a way, Crash is almost like a horror film in the sense that it reminds me of a vampire movie. The characters are like the living dead, but instead of being on the dead side of the living dead, they're still on the living side of the living dead. They're pale, they're suicidal. One of the characters' cars is like a moving coffin. There's blood throughout the movie. These characters
Well, it's interesting
feed
you say that because
other.
We also say that that car is also described as being like a bed on wheels. So it's kind of interesting that it's a bed that's also a coffin, you know. That once again, you've just mixed sex and death right there in that image of the car.
Oh yeah, right. Do you think that your interest in horror films affected your approach to telling this story?
Well, no, I think it's really the other way around. I think my sensibility is very well suited to the horror genre, and that came first. I mean, when I was a kid in school, I would write short stories that I think you'd have to say that they were horror stories. So when I first started to make movies, it was very natural for me to write a horror story. In retrospect, it seemed like a brilliant career move because that was in the early 70s, and that has sort of become, was at that time and has become the kind of traditional starting place for a first-time director to make a film in the genre, because even if you're not very good at it, you're rather inept, or you're learning how to make movies, you're protected by the genre. You know, it gives you a structure and a form, and it also gives you an audience. So if your film is low budget enough, you can be a first-time director and make a horror film. A lot of great directors like Coppola started making horror films, but they usually only made one. And then once they had somehow established themselves, they immediately left that genre, although even Coppola came back to it for Dracula.
What do you think it is in your sensibility that is so suited to the horror film?
Well, I think, first of all, I really love the kind of invention that you can do in a horror film. I love the freedom from mundane reality that is accepted within the genre without word, you know, without any problem at all. You can create things. You can create different creatures, different metabolisms, different mythologies, and I really love that about the genre. And also, of course, in my way of thinking, horror films are very body-oriented. I mean, death is seen as a very physical event, and as what I now consider to be a card-carrying existentialist, that is when I also see death as first of all a physical event. I mean, for me, and once again, it's through making my movies that I come to this understanding of myself. So, it is the process of making film for me is my philosophical voyage, you know, to come to some kind of understanding. And I do think of the human body as the primary fact of human existence. And this fits very well within the horror genre's mythology.
You're not just interested in death, you're interested in the decay of the body. In most of your films, the body is decaying. In the new film, we see scars and mutilation and crippling, and that's eroticized and fetishized in the new movie.
Yeah.
But again, it's wounds and
yeah, but it's also, you see, when you say that, I also say, but yeah, no, that means I'm interested in life, you see.
Right.
I mean, life in all its forms. In other words, not that there's this one perfect, healthy, normal version of the human body and that is life and that it begins to decay and disintegrate and then that is the beginning of death. Because, of course, here we are, this consciousness in this body that's decaying, and the consciousness is just as alive and hungry for life as it ever was. This is, of course, what everyone goes through in aging in general. So far from being sort of death-obsessed, I think I'm actually life-obsessed, and I'm so insistent on it that I will take it right to the edge of death. And then most people would turn away from that. I mean, especially in the West, the tradition of denial of death is very strong. So I really feel that I'm saying, as for example, the Rosanna Arquette character in the movie is technically crippled, disabled, but she's actually become, you know, the movie has been seen now by about 5 million people, and Rosanna, that character turns out to be a kind of an icon for the disabled. They like her. And the reason they like her is that despite the fact that she's been seriously maimed and scarred in a car accident, Rather than hide this, rather than think of herself as an inferior human being, she's incorporated her new body, her new physical self, into her sexuality. She's aggressively sexual and unashamed in it, and in fact incorporates what she is into her sexuality. And that is considered by the disabled a hopeful and approach, I mean a proper approach.
Let me just say, you know, just so people don't get the wrong idea that she's incorporated her sexuality into her being crippled by having, you know, like leather and steel braces and, you know, leather around her wounds. I mean, it's all very S&M and fetishistic. It's not nice guy kind of stuff.
It's not nice guy, but it's basically saying I have to wear these braces rather than hide them, rather than allow them to just be sort of clinical. I will try to make them attractive, and I will try to, you know, give them a meaning beyond just the fact that they're supporting my body and so on and so on. I mean, even to that extent, there were a series of wheelchair ads recently that were very controversial, showing a pregnant paraplegic woman, showing a crippled woman being very sexual and voluptuous and semi-naked in a wheelchair. And that came from the same impulse, i.e. to say, look, the fact that, well, let me put it this way. In England, there was one critic who said, and amongst the many disgusting things in this movie, there's a scene where someone has sex with a cripple. Well, you know, that got an incredible response. I mean, if you're married to someone who becomes crippled, does that mean that you should never have sex with this person again? I mean, does that mean that that person is no longer a sexual person? You know, so if you're going to come to terms with what you have become, you've been transformed. And of course, I see this as a metaphor as well for aging and just that kind of transformation that we all go through. But of course, it's in a more dramatic way. If you anyway, that's basically the structure that I see and the responses that I've gotten.
David Cronenberg directed the new film Crash. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Finish your story.
The junior pathologist at Ashford Hospital, then the husband of a colleague of mine, then a trainee radiologist, then the service manager at my garage.
You had sex with all those men in cars? Only in cars?
Yes, I didn't plan it that way.
Did you fantasize that Vaughn was photographing all these sex acts? As though they were traffic accidents?
Yes. They felt like traffic accidents.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, to keep looking when you want to avert your eyes. We continue our conversation with David Cronenberg about his new film, Crash. It's based on the 1973 novel by J.G. Ballard, who we'll also hear from.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Cronenberg. He directed the new film Crash and adapted the screenplay from the novel by J.G. Ballard. Cronenberg's other films include Scanners, The Fly, Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, and M. Butterfly. Crash is a disturbing film about a subculture that finds cars and car crashes mysteriously erotic. Let me tell you what I think is perhaps the most disturbing part of Crash. And, I think the most disturbing part is that, in a way, you're almost testing the audience. You're showing car crashes and erotic sensations at the same time. In the characters' minds, there's a link between cars, crashes, and sex.
Yeah.
And so you're making that link for the audience. And you're basically, the film is basically trying to turn on the audience, arouse the audience sexually at the same time that it's showing all these disturbing images. And you're almost saying to the audience, well, would this work for you? Can you be aroused by this?
Well, actually, I don't think I'm creating the link at all. I think I'm revealing the link that's already there. I think that that's really what's disturbing, is because the members of the audience who respond to that are kind of appalled by their own response. But I'm basically saying, look, the instant that you try to repress something, that's where the filmmaker's got to go. I mean, the play, when I know that I want to avert my eyes, then I know that that there's a reason for it, and I don't let go of it. I don't just avert my eyes. I have to understand why I want to avert my eyes. I know that that will reveal something to me about myself, even though it might be something that cerebrally I reject. But really, that if I want to understand myself, I have to look. And so I think that's really basically what I'm saying to the audience, because, as I say, the connection between sex and danger and sex and death and love and death is very well known and very well understood. Even on the primitive level of animals, when members of your species or of your tribe are being killed and slaughtered, there's a built-in primitive response to replace them, to reproduce. In other words, it's sexual, and we have that. The problem is that when that's politicized, it becomes politically incorrect. And people, of course, are worried that, oh, my God, that means you'll want to have sex while you crash your car. But that's not really what happens at all in the movie. I mean, it's these people in the film are coming to terms with their own relationship with mortality. They are not turning away from what mortality is and can be because they know it's inevitable, and they're grappling with it.
Do you ever find that you're sexually aroused by something that you actually find really disturbing and upsetting, and you don't know what to make of it?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people do as well. And it's funny because it's talking to people about it, you will start to get car crash stories from almost everybody. And some of them are very sexual. Sexual in the sense that, I mean, someone just told me a story about a crash that she saw in France. And Of a very beautiful woman who was dead in the back seat with her dress up around her shoulders. And everybody, all the cars were filing by very solemnly, looking really up this woman's legs. And it was very sexual, and it was very bizarre, and everybody felt extremely weird and ashamed and strange about it. But they still did it. They still slowed down. So, of course, anybody who has that response is going to be quite weirded out by it. But if it really is your response, then you've got to accept it, and you've got to try and understand what it means.
Do you try to censor yourself when you feel that something that philosophically shouldn't be turning you on is?
Philosophically, of course, I feel that nothing should be censored, and especially when it has to do with my own reactions, that I am shortchanging myself. I mean, as Socrates said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. That this is what you have to do to be a conscious human. This is really one of the things that you can do with your life. And if it takes you to some places that are very strange and obscure and arcane, then so be it. Politically, of course, there are things that one might want to suppress or repress, but the political process has a different function than the philosophical process, and I think the two kind of work together, they grapple together. That's really like art versus society, you know, art versus civilization. Art is always saying, look at the subversive things, deal with them. And civilization is saying, suppress the subversive things, don't deal with them. And both of those have a function together, and that's why there's this uneasy tension between art and society, but it's a necessary tension.
The novel Crash is filled with blood, sperm, mucus, and vomit. You left out the mucus and vomit from the film, and I'm wondering why.
Well, there are a lot of things in the novel that I've left out, but it's not really so much a matter of leaving out as what the difference is between the two media. I mean, I did feel that I wanted the movie to be seductive in a way that I feel the novel is seductive. But and I mean it this way. The novel begins by discussing things that you find repellent and unacceptable and things that you've never thought of before. And by the end of the novel, you are finding those things perhaps erotic, arousing, disturbing still at the same time. And so I wanted to do the same thing with the movie. And it's just the film is just a different medium. I mean, you know going in, and I've done this a few times with The Dead Zone and Naked Lunch, that you are going to create a new and different thing no matter what. You will not. There is no way to literally transliteralize a book to the screen. It just can't be done. And people who try to do it literally usually end up making a very stiff, dead thing on the screen, and we've all seen that. So it's a different, you know, it's a different ball game, really. You kind of have to, in a weird way, you throw the novel away. You have to betray the novel in order to be faithful to it. Vomit on the page is not the same thing as vomit on the screen.
Vomit on the screen would just be too hard to eroticize and work around.
Well, I've got blood, I've got sperm. I do have sperm.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm doing okay. 2 out of 3 for fluids.
No, 4. There was mucus in the book, too.
Yeah, I think we see a little mucus. We also see some coolant, radiator coolant, mm-hmm. and he's big on that in the book as well.
My guest is David Cronenberg, director of the new film Crash. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Cronenberg. He directed the new film Crash, about a group of people who are erotically aroused by cars and crashes. You know, this was a very funny week for me. By funny, I mean odd, peculiar, bizarre week for me to see your movie Crash. I was recently sideswiped by a bus, my car still in the shop, and I've been doing a lot of reading about airbags for a panel I'm going to be moderating. And as a short woman, I'm very worried that in a low-speed crash, an airbag.
You're worried you'll be decapitated.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But your film really creates its own reality in such a convincing way. I was mediating the two realities at the same time, the reality of cars in my life now, kind of disturbing, and the reality of your movie. And because the movie has such conviction and is so well done and this tone is so true to itself, I don't want to shake my fist at you and say, look, Mr. Cronenberg, you don't understand what it's like to, you know, to get sideswiped by a bus or to worry about airbags.
I was, in fact, sideswiped by a bus in Berlin in the 60s. I was in a Volkswagen Beetle at the time, so I actually even do know that.
Well, you were actually a racing car driver for many years,
yeah,
weren't you?
Not a professional, but even up to, even from the 60s to even up as recent as 2 years ago, yeah. But crashing on a racetrack is very different from crashing on the street. I mean, it's you spin off and you crash all the time when you race. I mean, if you don't, you're not doing it well enough. You're not serious enough. But, you know, you're strapped in with a 6-point harness. You have a fireproof suit. You have a helmet. You have people all around the track with fire extinguishers. And also, the traffic is going in one direction, and they expect you to spin. So it's quite a different, it just isn't the same. Even if the physics are the same, it's quite a different experience.
Okay, physically, what did you feel when you crashed? Did you see your life flash before your eyes? Did you think a lot about death? Or did you think, oh, it's par for the course, course.
No, I just wanted to get the car started again, get back in the race. I mean, that's really the main impulse that you have.
Okay, and I can't figure this. I can't figure someone who's as interested in death as you are. So you always explore death in your movies, and you're crashing and just thinking like, let me back on the track.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because that, see, that's being a racer. I mean, that's why it's different when you're on a racetrack. You don't expect, strangely enough, I mean, it's strange unless you've raced, you don't expect to die on a racetrack. You don't go into a race thinking you're going to die. You go into a race thinking that if you crash, how soon can you get back on the track? And how much money is it going to cost you to fix your car? It's quite a different thing. That's why I'm saying I've never had a serious road accident. And that would be quite different because your whole mindset is completely different at that point.
Weren't you in motorcycle crashes?
Everybody who's ridden a motorcycle has been knocked off his bike once or twice or fallen off. But nothing very serious there.
So what was the excitement that you found in racing?
Well, racing is a completely, I mean, nothing that I did in the movie Crash has anything to do with my experiences racing, other mm-hmm. than the fact that I could talk to my 35 stuntmen with some authority because I understood some of the forces that were involved in what we were doing with the cars. For me, racing is a wonderfully textured thing. I mean, there's a whole history to it, the history of the racetrack that you're racing on. I was racing vintage cars, finally, so I was racing cars that were old cars that had a history that meant something to me. Famous people that I knew and admired had driven these very cars that I was driving and the other ones on the track. So death is not, it's just not what you're thinking of. I mean, yes, there's excitement taking it to the limit, but I mean, it's really, if you go into a race thinking about death, you might as well not race. I mean, you've really lost the race for one thing.
What was it like for you at the end of a day shooting Crash when you'd get into your car to drive home and there you are in a car on the highway?
I thought nothing of it, you know. It's so interesting because what you mentioned before, the world that the movie creates, it is a kind of a dreamlike, a hermetically sealed universe.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
In the movie, and I have to sometimes point out to people that the movie is not meant to be taken literally, and there are many indicators in the film to suggest that the audience not take it literally. Although certainly a lot of people do their seatbelts up religiously after they get out of the movie, but even beginning with the opening credits and the opening music, I think you understand that the film works on a metaphorical level rather than a literal or docudrama type level. So it's not really about what about these people? What shall we do socially if these people actually exist? It has nothing to do with that. In fact, in the movie, the police almost don't exist. There are no. I've made sure that there are no sort of extras on the street. You don't have innocent bystanders who are or watching what's happening and we having to deal with their reaction, because I wasn't interested in that. And in fact, in the book, Ballard isn't interested in that either. So a lot of the things that happen in the movie in out on the streets would not happen because there would be other consequences of social ones and police ones that the characters would have to deal with. I wasn't really interested in, you know, the detective who's trying to crack this case and find out who's doing all these strange things on the highway, but that's why I don't have that character.
Ted Turner tried to stop the film's release and managed to hold it up for a while.
Yes.
And I understand the reason why is that he was afraid of the possibility of copycat incidents.
Well, that's what he said, but you see and I don't know the man personally at all, but what he was saying was quite ridiculous. Teenagers will have sex in cars. I mean, Ted, you know, I wish I could take credit for inventing that, but it's been going on for a long time. You know, an entire generation of people spawned in the backseat of 55 Fords. So, and here's a man also whose stations show Dukes of Hazzard, where you do have teenagers crashing cars without any consequences whatsoever, just straight fun. So I think it would be very hypocritical of him to criticize Crash for that, when in fact the characters in Crash are all in their mid-30s and are not teenagers, and in fact spend a lot of time dealing with the aftermath of crashes, which are not shown at all as being fun. So what I really think happened was that Turner was not able to deal with his own disturbed reactions to the film, and sort of clicked to the next available politically acceptable notch, which was this nonsense about, you know, what if everybody does what they see on the screen, which we all know is not true. His reaction was to try and suppress the film.
You know, it's funny. Car crashes are such a staple of action films. There's the car chase and the car crash.
Yeah, sex and cars are two of the most photographed things in cinema. And I did have to deal a lot with the logistics of an action picture, knowing that I was not making an action picture and that I wouldn't get the same points for doing action stuff. So I had all these stuntmen, you know, 35 stuntmen, 35 stunt cars on a rainy road at night. And I'm telling them, no, I don't want the car to, you know, flip over three times and explode in slow motion and do all that stuff. In fact, I do not want what you normally look to deliver with an action sequence.
What did you tell them you wanted?
I said that I wanted it to be very realistic and very brutal and very quick, and because I was more interested in dealing with the aftermath than the crash itself. At the same time, of course, I had to make it convincing. I mean, not, you know, it had to be realistic to the point that you could believe that the characters and the crashes were really happening in the same sort of creative space.
How explicit did you decide to make the sex scenes?
Well, it was, I mean, the book is very explicit, but it's explicit in a very bizarre way. I mean, trying to do a movie version of what the book had done, which I had found so odd and so strange, because everybody does everything in the book, but it's all described in a very clinical, detached way. And you see the residue of that in the movie. For example, there's a very sort of hot but strange sex scene between a married couple, in fact, where they're invoking Vaughn, this other character, verbally. And they're fantasizing about what they would both do with Vaughn sexually. And it's all described in very clinical terms. I mean, the sexual terms are medical ones, not street terms, you know. So it's not verbally hot at all. It's deliberately cooled off. And it's that strange tension between being sexually uninhibited and in the same way being quite sexually repressed at the same time that I was trying to deliver on the screen.
Your movie has an NC-17 rating. Did you expect that? Are you upset by it? Is that going to... Or did you just, you know, assume you'd get
that? Oh, no, we wanted...
That?
We all wanted the NC-17
Why
rating
did you want
very
it?
Badly. Well, because it was the only way to first of all, get this film to the public the way we wanted it. Because the R rating, as everybody knows, but maybe some people, in fact, don't know, always involves children. I mean, children will come to an R-rated movie if their parents bring them. A three-year-old could see Crash if Crash had an R rating. America desperately needs the NC-17 rating. There's no other civilized country in the world that does not have an adults-only rating. For some reason, that has been confused with porn here. But the end result is like having to, you know, run a family where no adults could have conversations together without a 10-year-old or a 3-year-old being present. How could you, if film is to be taken seriously as an art form in America, there has to be a rating which will allow you to make, as a grown-up, to make films for other grown-ups without worrying about the presence of children. I mean, it's just, you know, art, all art is not for children. So we were happy to accept the NC-17 rating.
Oh, one of the characters in Crash refers to himself as a partners in pathology. That's what he calls the group of people who, like him, are really into the car crashes.
Right.
And it's always interesting for me, but hard to explain why you can feel that watching somebody in a movie who is clearly pathological can be so revealing of the human condition, even though this person is so extreme and so far beyond anything that you really identify with or feel that you're like, and yet you see something of yourself in that.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, first of all, that's just the essence of drama, isn't it? I mean, it's that in the extremes, we illuminate things that we might not have seen if they weren't so extreme. And then you then try to apply that understanding that you've gained from the extremeness of it to your own life, in which those things are not so extreme but are there and now become more visible to you.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are going to assume, you know, that Crash is just a really sick, perverse movie by an exploitation director. You're clearly one of the intellectuals of contemporary cinema. Do you feel like some people are baffled? Like, well, if he's so smart, if he reads Plato, if he reads all these philosophers, what the heck is he doing making movies about car crashes and scientists who turn themselves into flies?
Well, I mean, when you want to, anybody who does anything that's complex and difficult and controversial is, you know, well, there will be some people who react that way. But, I mean, this film has already been chosen the best film of 1996 by the Cahiers du Cinéma, which is the premier French critical magazine, and so on. So I've got lots of support for the other side of the film, and for those people who don't understand what you're doing, there's no hope. I mean, basically, you cannot alter what you do in order to satisfy people who don't understand what you do. You have to do what you want to do.
David Cronenberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
David Cronenberg directed the new film Crash. He adapted the screenplay from the 1973 novel by J.G. Ballard. We'll hear from Ballard in a minute. This is Fresh Air. J.G. Ballard's 1973 novel Crash has just been published in a new edition to coincide with the release of the film. Ballard is also the author of the novel Empire of the Sun, based on his experiences growing up in a prisoner of war camp near Shanghai during World War II. Steven Spielberg adapted it into a movie. Yesterday, I called Ballard at his home in England and asked if he thought his interpretation of Crash was different from David Cronenberg's.
No, I don't. I think His film adaptation is extremely faithful to the spirit and to the letter of the book. No film can encompass in an hour and a half, you know, the whole of a 300-page novel. But I think he gets to the heart of the book in a brilliant way.
How do you think the effect of seeing the crashes and the sexual scenes compare on screen with the novel? The experience of reading it and the experience of seeing it.
Well, obviously, seeing a car crash or a sexual act on screen is much more powerful than any description a writer can cook up, because, you know, we primarily experience car crashes, if we're unlucky to be involved in them, or sex, if we're lucky enough to be involved in sex, through our eyes. And, of course, the eye has enormous authority. But I think you, in many ways, the car crashes and the sex in the film are less extreme than they are in the book. I think that's what's so powerful about the film, is that everything is understated compared with the sort of violent car crashes you see in most Hollywood films and the simulated sex that you see in Hollywood films. I mean, the sex and violence in Crash is quite modest.
What's the status of the film Crash in England? Is it going to be released?
The film was banned temporarily by Westminster Council, which covers the West End of London, where all the major theatres are. Without Westminster and central London, it's difficult for a film to get any kind of proper release. And there was a certain amount of government pressure at a very high level to get the film banned permanently. But now the British Board of Film Censors have suddenly come out and issued the film with a certificate and have not asked for any cuts, which is a remarkable development, given the huge storm of largely simulated outrage on the part of newspapers trying to sell their editions. But it's a step forward to eventual distribution of the film here.
Do you know anything about what happened behind the scenes that enabled the film to actually be released, especially be released uncut?
I think it's to the credit of the American chairman of the British Board of Film Censors, a man called Furman, who stood on his principles and has resisted government pressure. I think the part of the problem was that Crash got caught up with the imminent British general election and a panicky Conservative government, which is staring defeat in the face, was looking around for any bandwagon to climb aboard, and they saw this streetcar coming towards them labeled Morality, and they all rushed over, climbed on board, and started ringing the bell, and sadly, Crash was in their headlights. So I think it was used as a political tool, really.
I think you might be the only person in the world ever to have books adapted both by Steven Spielberg, the king of the big box office mainstream movie, and David Cronenberg, the king of the investigation of the most mysterious aspects of humanity. You know, his movies are always about body and soul.
Yes, I mean, I take it as a very great compliment that I've had what are probably my two best novels, adapted by two of the greatest directors.
In opposite extreme. I mean, everybody goes to see Steven Spielberg films and David Cronenberg's films. Some of them are just so, out of reach to people or something. I don't know what it is, because I think he's a wonderful filmmaker, but they certainly don't do as well. Some people think his films are kind of perverse. So, anyways, go ahead.
Well, I mean, there are many perverse. You know, life is perverse in part. I mean, the human imagination contains a great deal of perversity, and one shouldn't run away from it. I mean, it can get out of control, and then you get, you know, nasty aberrations like, you know, the Second World War. I think the perverse strains that make up the human mind ought to be kept under constant scrutiny. And I think novelists and filmmakers play a large role in carrying out that scrutiny. I think that's their greatest contribution to a civilized society. Somebody's got to, you know, explore the underworld.
J.G. Ballard is the author of the novel Crash. A new edition has just been published. We'll hear more of that interview with Ballard next Tuesday. And speaking of next week, on Monday, Academy Awards Day, we'll feature a special program, film critic Roger Ebert in conversation with Martin Scorsese, recorded at the Wexner Center for the Arts in Columbus, Ohio. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Richard Parker, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.